Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2012. Lecture 4, delivered on August 29, 2012. The title of this lecture is The Federal Reserve System.
Today, the Federal Reserve System. I would predicate the talk about the Federal Reserve by talking about the banking system in general in the United States. Now, I talked about financial intermediation, which can but does not have to go through banks. There are all kinds of different banks out there. And there are other financial institutions that do some things that are like banking services. For example, there are credit unions, which are like banks, but they're not exactly banks. So, just to give you an overview of the banking system in the United States, again, you have your classic bank, which is more or less a place where depositors put in money, and then the bank uses part of that money to lend out. And through that process, the bank profits and the money supply of the United States grows. And I'll mention a few other things like credit unions and S&Ls here in a minute. But well, actually, let me start it this way. Sort of a backdrop. We had a very big crisis in the financial markets of the world a few years ago. And I think I mentioned that we came very close to the end of the financial system in the world. It nearly collapsed under the weight of bad loans that were made, under the weight of lax regulation, under the weight of monetary policy and tax policy that were ridiculous, under the weight of imbalances in the global currencies, the system of exchange rates. All kinds of things were in play that came to a head in 2008. Now, I was writing in 2007 and leading up to into 2008 in the spring, warning that the system was under stress and it was going to buckle. My last article was in the spring of 2008 saying, we're going down. And we were, those few of us who were saying that were called conspiracy theorists and all that, whatever. It went to hell. We came within a couple of hours of having the global financial system collapse completely. That would not have been cool. It would have been worse than a zombie apocalypse because it, basically your paychecks, your savings, pensions, all that stuff, it would have been gone, just gone. And if you think zombies are bad, wait until you see people who don't have any money to buy food. They get awfully bitchy. So, what the hell happened? It was obviously someone's fault. Okay, we can talk about the global system of financial people. They were greedy sons of bitches. Well, yeah, they're humans. Sue us. We can talk about the regulators. Well, there was obviously a regulatory body that fell down. Okay, let's try that one. First of all, a system of rock-hard banking regulations that created walls of separation of banks doing banking business from doing other things, that put iron fist of regulatory oversight on the banking system in the United States. That had been put in place in the years of the Great Depression. It was called the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act was repealed in 1999. It's no longer needed. Banks can take care of themselves. Who cares what they do? They'll all, free markets. Let them do what they want, and then everyone will benefit from this freedom that we give to the financial sector. Well, you see what that came to. It took us to the gates of hell. In the place of Glass-Steagall was all that was left, which had also been in place for a long time, was a mishmash of regulatory oversight. Some banks are overseen by the Central Bank of the United States, the Federal Reserve, but not all banks. Some banks, state chartered banks, are overseen by state regulators. Other banks are overseen by the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Other banks are overseen by other regulatory agencies. There was and still is no central authority that sets up the regulations and then uniformly supervises those regulations and enforces their compliance in the banks. There is no central organization that does that. And at this point, there was talk right after the crisis, well, we've got to get it done, obviously. Well, of course, obviously the banking industry made a lot of contributions to politicians to make sure that nothing out of hand started. But also within the regulatory agencies, you want to talk about a turf war, my God. You're going to take our regulatory authority away and give it to them? And so you had this war going on, the banks and other financial institutions screaming, we don't need regulation. Here's some money for your campaign for you to see it our way. You had the regulatory agencies each saying, you don't take away our regulatory authority over this set of banks because that gives us power. And so where are we now? Nowhere. We are still right where we were in the years leading up to the crisis. Really, you know, you've had token little pieces of reform, but nothing comprehensive has been done. And that is, generally speaking, a prescription for a repeat of the disaster down the road, because there is no one who has the political will to be able to bring it all back together. There's talk, yeah, well, let's bring back Glass-Steagall. Ain't it gonna happen. No bank in the United States wants to see Glass-Steagall brought back, because that was too much oversight, and the banks are still saying free markets are the way to go. We can regulate ourselves, and we have all of these incentives to do right. We don't want to go under, so free markets have their own self-checking mechanisms, and anything that involves government regulation is obviously going to be inferior to the power of a free market to reward those who do right and to punish those who do wrong. And I leave it up to you in your years ahead to decide whether that really, really is the way it should be, or and how we could possibly get out of this current mess that we're in, which will lead to another crisis down the road within the next decade, about when you're out there in your jobs and you'll lose your jobs and then you'll be working at McDonald's. But, you know, that's not my problem. I'm sorry, that was harsh. Look. When I talk in this class about banks, I'm going to focus on the banking sector that is overseen by the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank of the United States. All developed countries, and even most countries that are underdeveloped, have a central bank, a bank that is the bank of the nation, that oversees the banks of the nation, that has various duties in different countries that central bank has, either large authority or narrow authority. In the United States, theoretically, the Federal Reserve has fairly wide authority, but it's, again, its authority isn't over all banks. So let me start this process out with you. By talking about the history, when I talk about free markets, we can go back to the last half of the 1800s. Now, after the Civil War was over, before the Civil War, you would have heard almost anyone in the country, in referring to the country as a whole, saying, these United States, Now, that was not just a linguistic quirk. It meant something deep in the sense of how we saw our country. We were first and foremost citizens of our state. And the Constitution was a treaty between a federal government and the several states. Essentially, these sovereign states would come together under limited federal authority to transact business, to recognize common interests, and for common defense in certain situations. But even in common defense, oftentimes the states saw their own militias as being primary to the defense of that state or commonwealth. So you would hear people say, these United States. It was only after the era of Mr. Lincoln who cracked down on this hyper-statehood concept that people began to see the United States as a unified body. But even in that era, after the Civil War, there was still this sense that the federal government was limited in its authority. It took an unbelievable amount of money and human life and property to impose a national will against slavery upon all of the states uniformly. Even in the years before the Civil War, non-slave states, free states, still had slaves. Illinois was quite into it. Illinois business people, mining interests and all that, could rent slaves from slave states. It was part of our law. The federal government had to get to the point where it was essentially killing an awful lot of people, and those southern states were killing an awful lot of the Union soldiers, before we finally got the message that, yeah, the federal government, we gotta listen to them sometimes because they can kick our ass. But nevertheless, there was still a sense that it was a state-by-state thing. Life was in your state. You were a citizen of your state, Kentucky, Illinois, Virginia, whatever. You were that state first. And as such, the federal government struggled to have any real authority at any given time. Slowly, the federal government, over the period of the last half of the 19th century, began to put a stronger and stronger handhold on the conduct of businesses and other interests within the several states. Nevertheless, if we want to talk about the financial sector of the United States, back in the 1880s, 1890s, it was just basically a pure free market. The party roared on, just rolled and rolled. In the financial sector, fly-by-night banks popped up here and there, issuing their own currencies, doing loans that were shady, having assets that didn't even exist. Investments were highly, highly suspect. Lots and lots of people lost all of their money to scam investments, and no one got burned. No one went to jail for it. In the banking sector, banks collapsed right and left. Sometimes because they were just shady as hell. Other times because they didn't have enough money in the vault when too many people came in to ask for their money. The banks had lent too much of it out. And you would have what is called a run on a bank. And once the bank did not have the money to give to people who wanted to demand their deposits back, the bank just simply folded right there. The consequence of that wasn't just for those people who had money deposited in that bank. It also would affect banks around it, because once one bank folded shop because it had only 10% of the deposits on reserve, then people would say, well, what about my bank? They'd run that bank. That bank might have 20% of its deposits on reserves, but everyone's panicking. Once 20% of the deposits were demanded back, that bank failed. And then these cascades would happen across banking regions. you would have major, major economic problems result from that. Not just microeconomic, macroeconomic problems. This got the attention of the federal government. Slowly, Clouville began to come in, and there were calls in Congress to stop this nonsense. Part of it was because of the shady banks. Part of it, quite honestly, was because of some very powerful, wealthy families and men who would essentially start bank runs, hint that a bank was in trouble when it really wasn't. Then, of course, too many people would go in for their deposits, the bank would fail, and then these rich people would walk in and buy up the bank, the chart. And who would have been doing that? Do you have any guy names?
Rockefeller.
Oh, Rockefeller was in on it. Who was the big dogs? They were still doing it in the 1920s. They pulled it again. Who was it? The Rothschilds. Yeah, the Rothschilds. I mean, it's not conspiracy theory. They did it in the 1800s. They did it again in the 1920s. They created, it's almost single-handedly, they created the many crises leading up to the Black Monday. One way or the other. Congress had, look, our government was the best government money could buy. Back in that era, literally, politicians, judges, everyone from the alderman up to the president were the result of decisions made in smoke-filled back rooms by powerful bosses of industry, by wealthy people. That's how it worked. You had a token few rabble-rousers like a William Jennings Bryan or someone like that, sort of the early equivalent of a Ron Paul. But for the most part, it was a system that was rigged from the bottom to the top in favor of these powerful, wealthy interests, industrialists, bankers, and rich families, and all that kind of stuff. How can you even hope for reform in an era like that? Well, it's interesting because we did see reform several times. The monopolies that were forming in the 1800s after the Civil War. Finally, the Congress, a bought and paid for Congress, passed antitrust legislation. It's interesting that way that in history we tend to think of the heroes, the reformers, as coming from outside the system, riding in on a horse, wielding a sword of rebel justice, and everything changes by the result of these radicals. Actually, interestingly enough, that's not the case most of the time. History, as it is written by popular authors and by the television and film media, misses the larger point that oftentimes reform comes from those who are fully aware of and have participated in the corruption of the system. And at some point, they turn and they do the right thing. And that was what happened with antitrust legislation. Later, in the 19-teens, we had a brief anti-big business period with the election of a president named Woodrow Wilson, perhaps the first modern liberal. He didn't last but one term. He got us involved in a nasty war, the Great War, which was later called World War I. But during his era, the government stopped beating up the unions, stopped sending federal troops whenever some big business wanted to break the back of a union. The government started really enforcing antitrust law seriously, passed a few tightening acts, putting into place the Federal Trade Commission in 1914, and in 1917 passed the Federal Reserve Act, which established the Federal Reserve Board. It did a lot of other things too, but it was the first effort of the United States to create a central bank that would oversee with federal mandate all of the laws that were being passed pursuant to reform in the banking industry. Now understand that it was actually still somewhat of a new concept. The idea that when you pass laws, when the Congress passes laws, that really doesn't do a whole lot in and of itself, because then all you've done is put on the federal prosecutors in the Department of Justice a whole new set of laws that they have to enforce. While they're enforcing laws against bank robbers, murderers, rapists, all kinds of other things, suddenly here's some more laws for them to enforce. The concept had been actually started in the 1800s, and then in 1914 with the Federal Trade Commission Act, the United States took a different approach. We will create an agency by law. That agency will have the power to enforce the laws that have to do with that agency's directives. So the Federal Trade Commission was charged with overseeing antitrust law. First, they would create regulations from the law that banks would be able to follow. Then they would go out and monitor and enforce compliance. That was the Federal Trade Commission's role. The courts were thrilled. We don't have to deal with this mess anymore. You must, if you are a business, you will deal with the Federal Trade Commission. And until you have exhausted all remedies within the FTC, don't come to us in the court system. Only if you have done everything that is available within the regulatory agency will the courts of the United States look at your case de novo, anew, from the scratch. But until then, the courts will say, the experts are in that agency, they understand the law, they have created the regulations, they have created the punishments and the incentives. You deal with them first. This is, again, how the Federal Reserve went about, the Federal Reserve Act went about it. Banking laws will establish a central bank. That bank will have the authority to interpret the laws, to write the regulations for those laws, and then to enforce those laws, those regulations on the banks. Now, usually these commissions, they deal in the civil actions kind of world. If something has risen to a level where you have criminal action, they will put together the initial case that will be then referenced to the Department of Justice prosecutors to hit the offender on the criminal side, while the commission itself beats them up on the civil side. Interestingly, the Supreme Court ruled not too many years ago that that's not double jeopardy. The government can beat you up both criminally and civilly on the same essential wrongdoing. But anyway, the Federal Reserve System was created in this act. And then the Fed, as we call it, was told, get to work. You create your internal structure. That's called the administrative laws of one of these organizations, of one of these commissions. Then you will create regulations. That's called its regulatory activities. And if necessary, you can actually create laws to handle things that the official books don't cover. That's called quasi-legislative activity. The Federal Reserve Act established the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System starts at its top with a Board of Governors. The Board of Governors has 7 members. One of those members is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. The chairman from the 1970s forward were Arthur Burns, then Paul Volcker, and after him, Alan Greenspan, and then Ben Bernanke, who is our current chairman. Each of them had a character and a quality. Burns was a pushover for anything. If money needed to be printed, he'd do whatever a president wanted. Paul Volcker stepped in 1979 at the behest of President Jimmy Carter and brought to an end an era of extraordinary excess. As a result of that necessary, bloody, brutal crackdown on the money supply, the economy plummeted into one hell of a recession, and Jimmy Carter was kicked out of office and Ronald Reagan came into office. People didn't understand that President Carter had thrown himself on his sword to basically save a nation from economic catastrophe. Paul Volcker, who was known in his era as Tall Paul, is still alive. He is actually an advisor to our current president, whom he seems to like. Paul Volcker, in his time, I met him once. Well, I didn't meet him. I was in the same room with him. Hugely tall man, smoked cigars. He didn't give a rat's ass what anyone thought of him. He'd blow cigar smoke in people's face. He was that much of a jerk. He was the kind of man who did what was had to be done in his era. His understudy was Alan Greenspan. In his early years, Alan Greenspan was considered sort of a hero in many ways, a man who had started his career as a saxophone player, an absolute acolyte, devotee, and friend of the extremist sociopath Ayn Rand, super individualism and all that. Alan Greenspan, in his early years, did some amazing things. For example, he was on the Spearpoint Committee that ended the draft in the United States, taking a conservative approach, but so there was both liberal and conservative signature to this idea of getting rid of a draft of people for wars. Later, Alan Greenspan led the Fed, and he did a good job of it in his early years. He began to turn really creepy in his later years, becoming very bitter about the success of the Clinton administration in the 1990s, doing whatever he could to try to wreck it. And ultimately, after the election of President George W. Bush, participated in the tax cut claims, the claims that we were in a recession that led to the tax cuts, that led to the disaster that had that followed in terms of our budget deficits. Ben Bernanke took over in 2004. By all accounts, he is a yes man, a kiss ass, and but he's very bright, and he's politically quite savvy, even though by most accounts he was a failure as a Federal Reserve chairman in his first term. He was reappointed by President Obama last year, mainly because he is so politically smart, he knows how to make presidents happy with him. Now, the seven members, including the chairman, are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. They are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. They serve considerable terms in office. Now, underneath the Board of Governors, now, in its role as the overseer of our banking system, the Board of Governors regulates. In other words, the Board of Governors writes the regulations that give life to the banking laws. Again, the Board of Governors regulates. That means that they write the regulations that give life to the banking laws. It's like the FTC has a set of commissioners. It's like the Environmental Protection Agency has a set of commissioners. The people at the top who actually interpret the law create the regulations. But regulations written are meaningless unless they can be enforced. This is where the next level of the Federal Reserve System comes in. We have the Federal Reserve Districts. Each one of these districts is served by a district bank. There are 12 districts in the system. 12 districts in the system. Now, here's the weird thing. This was all set up in 1917, 1918, back in the second decade of the 20th century. Well, the districts, if you look at the pattern, the districts on the East Coast are very small. As you go west, the districts get bigger and bigger and bigger. Because back then, there were not as many people, not as many banks, the farther west you went. So you've got like a district like the San Francisco district, which is enormous. Whereas you get the New York district, which is basically that circle, New York City. Well, it's a little bigger than that. So you got, and of course that means that nowadays, where so many people live in the South and the West, those banks on the, in the, especially in the West, they have a huge amount of work to do compared, comparatively speaking, because they have such so much, so many banks out there these days compared to what they did when the system was set up. But that's the way it was. Now, interestingly enough, if you look at a dollar bill, I think I have one, or did I spend mine on NOMS? Yeah, I got one. You'll see on our currency, you'll see a minting stamp. And that it's A through I or J, something like that. Each one of these represents where, that would tell you where this note was printed, which district bank, because that's one of their jobs, is to print money, literally to print the money. No, you can't go in and watch them do it anymore. It used to be you could actually watch the money being printed. I guess maybe they have like a glass window you can still see it through, but man, those places are secure anymore. Okay, now each of these districts, there are 12 districts, and each district has a district bank, a central bank at of the Federal Reserve for the district. Now, sometimes these in some of the districts, you'll have branches of the district bank. So you might have, for example, in the Chicago district, the Northern Illinois district, you might find a district bank branch somewhere other than at the main building. You go up to Chicago, there it is, right in the middle of town, of downtown, this block building, and you go in there and they that's a district bank. They're all over there. There's St. Louis, there's Chicago, of course there's one New York, which is called the Empire Bank, and I'll bring that up again in just a little while. The Empire Bank, San Francisco, Atlanta. I can't even name them all right off the top of my head. Okay, these district banks, each of them has a bank president, a district bank president. Now, that's important because these cats play a role with the Board of Governors. Now, as far as these people in the Federal Reserve System go, the governors and the district bank presidents, historically, they have been the cream of the crop. I mean, above reproach. Perfect suits, perfect manner, politically brilliant, economics degrees, finance degrees, just geniuses. I don't think they even have sex. I've never asked one of them that, but I've actually wondered in my mind, dude, is there anyone who would have sex with you, man? You know, well, that's right. You make a huge amount of money. I never did that, though, because I wanted to be invited back. But now, these, interestingly enough, though, remember I talked about regulation? The Board of Governors regulates the federal district banks and force. So in other words, the regulations are written, and then they are promulgated by the Board of Directors. They're then promulgated to the district banks, who then go out there and they enforce these at the line level on the banks in their district. So the Chicago branch will go out and they will just go to every bank. They will audit those banks as they wish and they will enforce the regulations that are written by the governors. It is the job of the central bank to write the regulations. They then promote these down the line to the federal districts. And then those federal districts promulgate those out into the banking community. All right, here's the new rules that have been written by the Board of Governors. And we're going to be enforcing those rules. So regulation and supervision, enforcement, I should, and let me put this supervision, because sometimes you'll hear, they don't like the word enforce because it sounds like they're mean. But they will supervise. And this is, if you're interested in it, these banking regulators that work for the Treasury Department, that work for the Federal Reserve, for the FDIC, these cats, they hire. And there's something interesting about these government jobs. They are not subject to budget cuts and all of that kind of stuff because these are self-earning entities. They charge the banks fees. And so they live off what they earn in their activities. So as last year we had regulators from the Treasury Department who came and spoke to the Financial Management Association, the ISSF, the Illinois Students State Students in Finance. And she just said her life, 4 days a week, she's out in the field with her team supervising the banks, auditing, going through the books. She's home pretty much every night. And she has a four-day work week. She has 6 weeks of vacation a year. Federal health insurance, which is absolutely excellent. And she makes a rather appallingly good amount of money. And she and her people who work with her are never going to lose their jobs as long as they don't screw the pooch, because budget cuts don't affect them, because they live off the fees they charge the banks that they regulate, that they supervise. And she said, oh, by the way, we are hiring, always hiring, looking for bright people. So if you're looking for something in federal service, it's not the worst life in the world. At the IRS, I have an IRS people who've talked to me about having Treasury Department, having some of my better students apply for Treasury Department jobs as IRS enforcers and Treasury Department enforcers. You get to wear a badge and a gun, which is kind of creepy as hell. But anyway, that's the system in sort of a broad outline. Now, let me go through. The Federal Reserve has three different jobs. Its first job is to regulate and supervise, as I just explained to you, the three jobs of the Fed. Its first is to regulate and supervise. Then it has a second job, which is rather interesting because it gets into a fascinating little political thing that it would help if everyone knew this, but not hardly anyone knows it. The Federal Reserve also serves as a bank for banks. A bank for banks. Banks have to have a place to put their money, just like people, just like businesses do. You can't deposit a bank can't deposit its own money in its own bank. It has to have another place to do it. The Federal Reserve is a bank where banks can deposit their money. That pool of money from banks depositing their money in the Federal Reserve system is called the federal funds market. That'll come up again later, but that's the federal funds market. Now, here's the interesting thing that has a political side to it. You see, the Federal Reserve is tasked with competing against commercial banks that also are banks for banks. So, in other words, the Federal Reserve Bank goes right out into the open market and competes against these ginormous, huge banks that provide banking services for banks. The Federal Reserve is in the market, first of all, to foster competition so that these commercial banks can never collude, because the Fed is there in the market too. And if they start jacking up their fees, the Fed's right there to do it, to fight for business with them. And also, the Fed is required, whenever it develops new technology or it advances systems understanding and networking, it shares that with the commercial banks that compete against it. So the Federal Reserve's bank for banks job fosters competition, and it also promotes technological innovation. So the fact that you can have your debit card analyze it, make sure there's enough money to buy something within a fraction of a second, that's because the full weight of the federal government through the Federal Reserve created the technology to do that kind of stuff. All of those things are innovations. Commercial banks try to keep up with it, but the Fed's constantly coming up with great stuff. and it just shares it with the banks it competes against for business of other banks. Now, funny about this because I've taught this for years and years, and I actually didn't know the balance between how much bank business does the Fed get versus how much bank business do the commercial banks get. Is it like the Federal Reserve is just destroying the commercial banks that give banks banking services, or is there a healthy amount of competition? I checked down with St. Louis, and it's by district, and the St. Louis tech people told me that they have about 65% of the business in the St. Louis district. 35% of the banks do their banking through commercial banks. 65% do their banking through the Federal Reserve's St. Louis branch. So there is a balance there. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. You see, what that means, and by the way, this has been going on for years. That stability, that number apparently has been around for a long, long time. The commercial banks have their business. The Federal Reserve has its business. And the Federal Reserve makes unbelievable money off what it does. In fact, the Federal Reserve just 2 days ago transferred to the United States Treasury $46 billion in profit it has earned doing this. And yet it has not destroyed the private market of the commercial banks that do the same business. In other words, for decades, maybe almost a century, there has been a public option that banks could use for their services, and it did not destroy the private sector. There was a huge, huge cry in 2009 and 2010 when there was talk of having the government provide health care coverage, insurance. That'll destroy the private sector. We can't have a public option. That would just wreck the private sector. There would be no more private health insurance. You would ruin great companies. You would ruin jobs in the private sector. Can't happen. That's socialist. We can't have that in this country. Good God, to the tune of $100 billion business, there's a public option for banks. They can go with a private commercial bank to do their services, or the public bank to do their commercial service, to do their banking services. It's been there. It hasn't destroyed the commercial banking sector, private banking sector, and it has been profitable, and it has fostered competition. The fees are brutally low in the industry. Banks pay good low fees for their banking services, probably better than people do. It's been going on for decades. So a public option has been available to banks for decades and decades. And yet there was such a scream that would destroy the world if we did that with health insurance. Not that health insurance is a great idea on a national level, but the argument that you can't have that because it would destroy the private sector insurance system, we've got a model, a profitable, an unbelievably profitable model that has made the private sector strong by providing them with technology and forcing them to compete in a rough market against a big gorilla. Okay, that's the second job. The third job is to conduct monetary policy. Conduct monetary policy. Now, this is done through the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee. I'll get to that in just a minute. But first, understand that the macroeconomy within the as it is affected by the government has two components. There is fiscal policy, and then there is monetary policy. Fiscal policy is set by the Congress and carried out by the executive branch, the president's people. Fiscal policy is created through taxes and spending by the Congress. And then those rules that are set up by the Congress, those laws are enforced by the Treasury Department of the United States, which is under the authority of the President. Monetary policy is conducted by the Fed, which is semi-autonomous. It cannot be ordered by the President or the Congress to do what the President or the Congress would want. Now, the President can appoint the chairman with the advice and consent of the Senate. The Senate can haul, and the House of Representatives can haul the governors in and eat them alive in committee hearings and all of that. They can bitch and fuss, but they cannot force the Fed to do anything. The President can't either. The President can be nice to the Fed people. The President can be harsh with them. He can bring them into the Oval Office, close the doors, and rip their asses, but he can't make them do anything. You see, the idea was, when the Federal Reserve System was set up, was to make monetary policy so that it was not subject to the political process. The truth of the matter is that political process produces ass results quite frequently. You pander to this constituency or that constituency. You figure out where the wind is blowing this year, where the wind is blowing next year. You figure out who's got the most money and you do what that group wants. You pretend that you believe in their values and then you pass laws that promote those values, or you posture that you will. The political process can get us into worlds and worlds of trouble with monetary policy. Because Congress or the President could say, print money. Just print it and give it to everyone. And then, sure, that would be very popular at first, but you will create insane inflation as a result of that. See, here's the interesting thing. That fiscal policy is subject to the political process. Completely subject, a victim of the political process, which is why you will have taxes go up, taxes go down, taxes that pander to the rich, tax benefits that pander to the working poor, whatever. So you get all that political process plays in on the fiscal side, and we get a mess. On the monetary side, though, Congress, in some insane burst of wisdom, separated the Fed from the political process. And like I said, you can do all kinds of things to the Congress can beat up the Fed, they can scare them, they can threaten them. Right now, the big thing is threatening to audit the Fed. Try your best to make the Fed do what you want, but at the end of the day, the Fed is no one's bitch. That's just the reality of it. I always wondered why I never got a job at the Fed. It's probably for things like that. Actually, I was thinking about it. I wrote an article a couple of years ago. You see, the Federal Reserve is political. They are a political animal, those cats. One of the things that they do every year is they have this big conference where they bring in the professors in economics and finance from all around the country to the different Fed districts, and they just lavish it on. Meals, booze, conferences, you get to shake hands with the district bank president. It's just nothing but a damn love fest. And that way, all of the people who teach the subjects like I do see it the Fed's way, and they think that the Fed is the greatest thing since Jesus Christ. I have been a vicious critic of the Fed. Published articles, monetary policy. Here's how it works. I want you to remember something that I did in the last lecture, where I showed you that when a price of a debt instrument goes up, the yield on it goes down. That's one of those rock-solid relationships in finance. Price of a security goes up, yield on the security goes down. Now, in order to conduct monetary policy, the Federal Reserve uses that mathematical truth. And this is how it does it. Well, let me point this out. I should say this. The Fed actually has three tools of monetary policy. Now, some of them, now, these tools, I'll go from the bluntest one up that's hardly ever used through to the most refined one that's used every day. Now, the bluntest one is what is called the required reserve ratio. This is one that would not be used very often at all. It actually is a tool of monetary policy, but it also has a regulatory power in it too. You were walking along the street and you found $1,000. I mean, there it was. Just, whoa, that's cool. So you go to the bank. You go to the bank and you put in that money into the bank. $1,000. Now we're going to call that the base money, M0. Okay? It comes in autonomously. Truth be told, the Fed printed it and put it there on the sidewalk for you to find. Who knows? But this money kicks in the system. Now, I am the bank, and I see that, why, yes, sir, we'll put your $1,000 in a very safe place, and it will be there whenever you need it. And you feel really confident because, I mean, it's me, and I exude confidence. Okay. Now, as soon as you walk out of the bank, I say, wah-ha-ha. Because, you see, I know darn well, on average, people don't come back and say, I want my $1,000. People don't come in with checks drafted on that, demanding money off your account. A check is nothing but a demand on your account. It's not going to all be demanded immediately, and it's just sitting there, for God's sake. So I figure, on average, I probably would see you want no more than 10% of that at any given time. And so we look at the regulations, and it turns out that the central bank is requiring a reserve of 10%. So I'm going to have to keep $100 of that money in my vault to satisfy demands against your deposit. The rest of it, suddenly you come in to my bank. I should like to borrow some money. Well, really, why? I want to start a business. Well, what do you want to do? I want to start a mail escort business. Wait, what? Yes, here's my business plan. Damn, that's good. Okay, so I lend you a $900, and you hire this man as a consultant that sets up the website. I don't know, Studs or Us or something, I don't know. And you set up the website, and you get the infrastructure going, and you make sure that you get some guys from the fraternity here at Illinois State to, okay. Okay, but he pays you the $900. You come back to my bank, and you deposit $900. So that goes on my books as a deposit. Oh, well, okay, well, I got to keep 10% of that. Federal Reserve says so. But you see, what's happening here is that now I still have another $810 that I can lend out to you. You decided that you wanted to start your own business making dried flower arrangements. It's been your dream. I'm okay with it. So you are going to need money. How much? 810. Well, spank me, Jesus. That's what I've got. So you order flower baskets, you know, the wicker baskets, and dried flowers, and obviously some ribbons, and I'd recommend like a lavender fragrance to go in them. Okay, some chamomile, you know. And so you pay him the $810. He comes to my bank, and he puts in that $810. That goes as money in my bank. You might be saying by now, wait a minute, isn't this what we call a Ponzi scheme? Yes, it is. Now shut up and pay attention. I hold $81 of that on reserve, and so I have $729 ready to lend to the next person. Do you see what's happening in this system? Is that the initial deposit through the fractional reserve system is turning $1,000 into considerably more than $1,000. How far does it go? I can give you the formula for it. The total change in the money supply of the nation from this process would be the original amount kicked in times 1/1 the required reserve ratio. So in this, and this thing right here, that's called the simple money multiplier. Now, I can give you one where people keep a little money in their pockets, but don't worry about that. The idea here is pretty obvious, the simple money multiplier. So in this case, we'd have $1,000 times 1/0.10. So the change in the money supply, this number will come out to be, the money multiplier will be 10. So we would have a total of $10,000 created from a single $1,000 deposit. Now, let me point out, do you see how blunt this instrument is? The Fed sets that rate. If the Fed were to say, we want you to keep more in the bank because we're worried about people coming in to get their money, so we want to make sure you have enough. If it sets it up to 20%, then the multiplier drops to 5. So in other words, the Fed playing with this multiplier moves the money supplies change quite a bit in any given situation, for any given amount. Now, here's the part that was quite a surprise to me. One of those things where you have to keep learning what you're doing even after you think you know it all. I've been waving my hand, you know, for years teaching this, saying, well, the money multiplier, I think it's around 10%, something like that. And finally someone asked me, what is it right now? And it struck me, I have no idea what it actually is. So I called the St. Louis Fed and I said, okay, what's the required reserve ratio? Well, it turned out it wasn't as simple as I thought it was. You see, because it turns out that the required reserve ratio is different for different tranches, in other words, levels of money. So the first $0 to $10 million of a bank's Tier 1 assets, the required reserve ratio is not the same as it is for the tier from 10 to 50 million, and then there's a required reserve ratio from 50 million up to the limit. The sky's the limit. And I thought, well, that's interesting. They actually fine-tuned this required reserve ratio so that small banks with lower total tier ones or large banks in their first levels of money have a bigger accelerator money multiplier than they do for the higher-end money. And so I've asked the second question. Okay, what's the first tranche required reserve ratio? And he said, it's 0. What? The required reserve ratio for the first $10 million of a bank's Tier 1 assets, Tier 1 capital, is 0? Yeah. Okay. Let's see how that works. 1/0, isn't that the thing that makes your calculator look at you stupid? Uh-huh. So theoretically, the money multiplier on the first tranche in the lowest end of the banking system is infinity. Yeah? Is there a problem with it? Well, yeah. And he said, well, it's been working. Okay, I guess. You know, that's weird as hell. So it actually is not the same for different tranches. So when you see in like a typical textbook, they say this. Now, who knew? I'm going to do the other parts next week. Online this weekend, you'll have some readings and you'll have a quiz to take. That'll be up to on Friday. That's all I have for you. I thank you.